Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's a devastating story, how over the last century, millions of acres of agricultural land was taken from African-American farmers, often legally, but sometimes coercively, sometimes violently. Injustices that over time stripped black farmers of their economic dream, their American dream. And in his cover story for The Atlantic, Van R. Newkirk II winds us through decades of the how and why of this land loss and shows us the implications for all of us today. So this hour on Point, land, loss, and the African-American farmer. And you can join us. Does this story resonate with you? Is it your story? Is it your family's story? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us from Washington is Van R. Newkirk II. He's staff writer at The Atlantic, and his September cover story is titled The Great Land Robbery, the shameful story of how 1 million black families have been ripped from their farms. And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Van, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, can you tell us, you center a lot of your reporting in this story in Mississippi. Why is that?
The Mississippi Delta is a place that is described alternatively by poets and writers as a place that's like almost like the Fertile Crescent or like the Nile River Delta. It's this place that's extremely productive and emblematic of the history and shape of American agriculture. Obviously, it's a place that originally was inhabited by Native Americans, by the Choctaw, and by their predecessors in Mississippi. And then it's taken from them by force, by the white settlers. It's part of the frontier for a little while. And then once it's cleared, it becomes the center, the seat of the American slave empire. So from there, it's kind of it represents almost a microcosm of the entirety of American history, from colonialism to sharecropping to now the present day, which is the current story about tariffs and soybeans also is happening in the Delta.
So walk us through in more detail some of that history, because I think it helps to it'll help a lot to understand where we are today. Just post the Civil War, what was the process like for African Americans, newly freed African Americans, and their attempts to secure some land?
Yeah, the famous promise for freedmen after the war was that they would get 40 acres and a mule. Mm-hmm. And regardless of the actual shape of that promise, what people believe they would actually get, one thing lots of formerly enslaved people believed that they were due and owed from the government was land. And in lots of places like South Carolina, Georgia, they were able to get a little bit of land. In South Carolina, they were given the old plantations in lots of cases. And across the country, although the Freedmen's Bureau never really in Reconstruction followed up totally or even close to totally on that promise of 40 acres and a mule, some black folks were able to get some land. And that's through initiative, through lawsuits, through land grants, whatever it may be. In Mississippi, the story is a little bit different. During Reconstruction, black folks got almost no land. The slave regime in Mississippi was so strong and powerful, the plantation owners were so powerful, that they were able to keep most of the black folks there as sharecroppers on their land. Mm-hmm. And 20, 30 years after the war, living in conditions that were not much different than they were during slavery. But they were still not able to pressed totally against the tide of the fact that Mississippi was something like 60% black in the 19th century. There were just so many black people who were then free that over time, you see hundreds, you see thousands of them able to get a couple acres of land here and there. And over time, they become a sizable piece of the land ownership in Mississippi.
How sizable?
So it's never anything close to what the plantation owners own. But actually, in some counties in the Delta, you do have more black landowners who are farming than white landowners. You have in places like Tunica County, they outnumber them 2-1 at some point going into the 20th century. Across the state, you see, although the acreage never gets close because plantation owners tend to own these ridiculously large plots of land, you see the number of people who own land come not, if not close to equivalence, it's respectable. You know, you get, in especially in the Delta, you do have close to equal numbers of landowners.
So, and just to state the obvious, and forgive me for doing so, I feel like we can't overstate how important it was economically, socially, spiritually, to be owners of the very land that they themselves or their predecessors had been put into bondage to work. And I just want to talk about that a little bit for a second, because I mean, that's the thread of history that runs through to today. I mean, how vital was it for the African American community to have some sense of, not sense, but reality of ownership over this land?
Right. That is the a true piece of the symbolism that I think people often overlook of land ownership, especially land ownership in the places, around the places where people's ancestors were kept as and enslaved. You saw it when some folks in South Carolina were able to get the plantations from their owners. You saw it in Mississippi when actually the people who were enslaved on Jefferson Davis's brother, his plantation, they took it over and they had pride in it. And part of it was because, number one, that's what you know. That's where they grew up. You know, it was home. And one of the promises that was really sort of moved them was the ability, the dream of owning some piece of that home, of having the ability to take the thing that you once made productive for somebody else and make it productive for yourself, being able to eat off of it, being able to live off of it, and being able to set yourself up as a person who's lived and had these same kind of freedoms that you once worked your entire life to provide to somebody else. And also just having something to where people cannot move you. I don't think people properly understand or place the fear of being moved that was so central to slavery, the fear of being sold that was so central to slavery. And what is the ultimate expression of the opposite of being in a position in society where you can be bought and sold at whim? It's owning something of your own that cannot be bought and sold from you unless you want to sell it. And that keeps you anchored, keeps your family mm-hmm. anchored in one place, gives your family, your descendants, as far as they can hold on to it, gives them a place they can keep their feet on and not be moved from.
But you're right. I mean, the whole thrust of your article here is about how, even with that profound importance of this land, from the start, from the get-go in Reconstruction, that the foothold that these African American farmers had or were able to gain was always very tenuous. There was pushback from the start. So can you just describe what some of that was?
Yeah. So the dream of those folks who got the land never quite matched up with the reality and with what those plantation owners, their children, were going to allow to happen. So almost from the jump, from the start, when black folks across the country, and especially in Mississippi, start owning significant plots and tracts of land, you see local white farmers apply pressure to keep them from it. So in Mississippi especially, the plantation owners wanted to keep those black folks as laborers. They did not want them competing as landowners across the street when they could own the land and keep those black folks on it, keep their children and grandchildren on it too. So when, you know, the basic level of discrimination where black folks were not able to get loans and white folks would not sell to them land in the first place, those who were able to get it often found themselves needing loans. They couldn't go to banks. Banks wouldn't work with black mm-hmm. folks. So they had to rely on the plantation owners themselves for credit. And those plantation owners, why would I give you credit if I want you as a sharecropper on my land. And so they would offer either unfavorable terms that would see those black folks go into bankruptcy pretty quickly or just not offer them. That's the way it was until federal intervention. It was kind of the Wild Wild West. Mississippi was still very much a frontier place in many ways. And the plantation owners kind of just ruled everything with an iron fist. Whoever got land, they didn't get it because they were necessarily thrifty or better than anybody else. They got land because they were allowed. And the implicit understanding was that if you were allowed to get land or become a landowner, the plantation owners around you could just as quickly take it from you.
Yeah. And let me just ask a basic question, but and forgive me if this seems too obvious, but did these black farmers, did they actually have like legal title to the land? Because I think, as you write, a lot of the ways that the land was stripped from them was through sort of legal shenanigans. But did they ever, were they given the dignity of having a piece of paper that said, this is mine, I own this?
Oh, yeah. Part of the research that I did for this was I spent months combing through the county courthouses in the Delta, in the state library in Jackson. And just, you know, I could have just written on the richness of black land deeds in the area, on exactly the kind of notes they wrote with them, of the importance that they held, of how black folks kept copies of the deeds underneath their pillows sometimes. You know, they had the documents. And oftentimes they kept them pretty scrupulously, probably more so than lots of the local white farmers, because they knew that if you did not have this documentation, if there was a day in which you had a lapse, in which you had at least some small way for people to challenge your claim on that land, it would be taken.
Well, and then you write about how in a century, 12 million acres of black-owned farmland has been taken. So we're going to hear a little bit more about how that happened when we come back. We're talking with Van R. Newkirk II. He has a fantastic cover article in The Atlantic for September's issue called The Great Land Robbery. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Van R. Newkirk II. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he has written the September cover story for The Atlantic magazine. It's titled The Great Land Robbery, The Shameful Story of How 1 Million Black Families Have Been Ripped from Their Farms. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Van writes about how some 12 million acres of black-owned farmland has been lost by these families. And we want to know if that's your story, if it's a story familiar to you or your family. Again, we're at 800-423-8255. And actually, let's go straight to the phones here. Let's go to Terry, who's calling from Florence, South Carolina. Terry, you're on the air.
Yes, how you doing?
Doing well. Go ahead.
I want to say that we have land that's in my family. Next year, 2020, will be 150 years. And it's very difficult sometimes to hold on to the land, because sometimes you have family, because it's heirs property, family members fighting against it, want to get rid of the land. But for us, the blessing is that it's so entangled in heirs, it's very difficult because they don't have a clear title. So we've been blessed in that way to keep the land. And I actually we have a Come Celebrate Jamestown every year in Florence, and actually did a T-shirt in 2018 talking about black land ownership. So this is a very beautiful topic to me that needs to be talked about more. And I appreciate what you're doing, and preferably that more African-Americans will want to own land or keep their family's land. But for us, my great-great-great-grandfather bought the first part of land, 109 acres, back in 1870 from two white landowners, Eli McKisson and Mary Poston. Okay, those two people let one person have to leave town because they threatened the white gentleman to take his life because he sold land to a black man. And the other part was that 20 years later, five sons and a son-in-law bought additional properties. All together, it's 246.7 acres. We have it still in the family. So I've been dealing with my family members. Sometimes they're brutal, but I still love them as family. But they don't. I don't think they really understand the importance of black land ownership.
Mm-hmm. Terry, don't go away yet. So tell us, why is it important to you?
Well, because, number one, I feel that my ancestors really struggled to keep the land. And it gives us self-sufficiency, not relying on anybody else, because it became a township. And now it's a historical district because we were on the National Registry as of last year, October. So for me, it's very, very important because what we try to do is to teach young people without land, you can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, land ownership is important. And back in those time periods, if you wanted to experience true freedom, you had to have land.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's important to me because of my ancestors and what they have accomplished, not just to give it back or throw it away.
Terry, again, don't hang up on us here. Hang on here for a second because I just was wanted to turn back to Van here. And hey, Van, do you want to talk to Terry? Because it sounds like his story is exactly what you've written about in your piece.
Yeah, Terry. I mean, I think I've gotten, well, number one, my family is wrapped up in this too, right? When I told my grandparents I was working on a story about black land ownership, that's the first thing they told me were all these stories about how we got the land that we had and where it came from and what it meant. And that's something that's been drilled into my head for a very long time is the importance of land ownership and what it did to members of my family when they lost it. So, Terry, you know, I think, and I'm from North Carolina, so
okay.
Yeah, I completely understand.
Right.
This, and the heirs property problem is, there have been really good pieces on that. I didn't focus on it directly in this mm-hmm. piece, but obviously
right.
it's right now. It is the way lots of people who managed to hold on to the period I talk about in the
yes.
piece. Now they're losing it because of the air property problem.
Yeah. Well, Terry, thank you so much for your call. That's Terry calling us from Florence, South Carolina. Van, so let's talk in more detail about the forces that led to the loss of the land that you write about in your piece for The Atlantic. I'm looking here. You say that between 1950 to 1969, right? Some 6 million acres of land was lost by black farmers. And as you put it, that's an average of 820 acres a day, the area the size of New York City's Central Park every single day. What was driving that?
The reason I focus on this period, the whole, I'm talking about the whole of what happened in the 20th century, yes, and that's 12 million acres was lost across a century. But what you cite is just across 19 years, two decades, half of that loss occurred. And what is that time period that we usually associate with? It's from 1950 to 1969. That's the Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm pointing out here is the fact that even as black folks gain the ability to vote, even as we get Brown v. Board and all deliberate speed, even after we have the Montgomery bus boycotts, even after we have all of these things that are considered signature pieces of a revolution in America, at the same time, a counter-revolution is happening literally under people's feet. And it is powered by federal money. Federal programs during the Great Depression to save farming essentially created a structure where the federal government would provide loans to farmers so they could plant. And those loans were administered by locally elected committees. In the South, we know that black folks could not vote. We know that white men were the people who controlled all the levers of power. And essentially, the federal government gave them one more really lucrative lever of power. So instead of the old kind of plantation model where, you know, black folks would have to apply directly to the plantations. They would have to live under their thumb. But if they were able to impress the plantation owners or just kind of scrape by, they could luck out and get some land. And that land would let them live kind of independently. The federal government gave those the white farmers even more power and tools to disenfranchise and discriminate against those black farmers in the 50s, 60s, 70s. So you look at if a person wanted to go and join the NAACP, now the local white farmers had the most powerful tool available, not just lynching or violence. They could just say, we're going to not give you the loans you're due this year, and we're going to take your land.
Well, I mean, as you point out, in 1965, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights documented the massive differences in the loans that were given to black and white farmers.
Yeah, huge disparities. And not just one piece of this that you have to disentangle is the middle of the 20th century was bad for all small and medium-sized farmers, mm-hmm. right? White mm-hmm. farmers. We don't get the grapes of wrath for nothing, right? But if you look at the disparity, even among small farmers, of over how much federal loans each family was able to get, it's a massive disparity among small farmers between white and black farmers, how much white farmers got, how much black farmers got. And black farmers, almost to a person, did not get the amount of loans that would have been considered standard for keeping a farm afloat. So every year they went more and more into debt. They went more and more into dependency. And eventually what happens is they have to go up to auction, they have to foreclose. And who's waiting to buy that money but the people that stopped giving them the loans in the first place?
Wow. Well, so we'll dig more into that in a couple of minutes, Van. But you tell a lot of this story through a particular family, and the Scott White family. And we're going to hear from a member of that family in a couple of minutes. But I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the Scott White family and sort of what it is about their story, their history that's so emblematic or central to the story of black farmers in Mississippi.
Oh yeah, the name of the Scotts is one that you will if you mention it in the Mississippi Delta, in and around Cleveland, in Ruleville, people will know who you're talking about. They are came over to Mississippi from Alabama in the 1880s under the patriarch Ed Scott Sr. He is a person who I believe that if he were probably if he were white, he'd be a guy in the tall tales. You know, he was like a John Henry almost. He should have been a senator. Just an incredibly brilliant guy who comes over and knows how to farm the way, I don't know, Einstein knows particle physics, right? He comes over and becomes immediately valuable because he's really good at farming. And he's so good at farming that he manages to convince one of the local white landowners who wants to sell to him, sell him 100 acres. So he becomes one of the first medium-sized landowners in the area and builds onto that plot over time. His family grows. They each get their own land plots. They build about 1,000 acres, a pretty big, sprawling farm. I don't want to say empire, but an estate almost. His son, Ed Scott Jr., takes the mantle in the middle of the 20th century, builds on more and more onto the land, and also is this impossible character of Will, who in some respects in the local areas is respected even more than the local small white farmers. He is that good at what he does. One thing that's critical about both of them is that they do not take or seek money from the federal government often. They know what the score is, and they prefer to rely on friends if they need to or self-sufficiency. But in the 1970s and 80s, when we have the major farm crisis and inflation crisis, essentially Ed Scott Jr. is put up again in a position where he has to ask for money. And he goes, he gets a white lawyer, he drives up, the local USDA office allows him to get a loan that he needs. Works out for that year, comes back the next year without the white lawyer and with a new truck. And they start to look at him a little bit differently, according to the family story. And so they become kind of hostile to him. And the story takes a downturn when I write it, when he becomes a historical figure for a second time, Ed Scott Jr., and decides to get into catfish. Mm. And the USDA is providing millions of dollars to farmers in the region to create what is our domestic catfish industry today. But they don't offer Ed Scott Jr. the same amount of money as they do all these other, frankly, inferior farmers who don't know what's in and out, who don't know farming as well as he does. He still manages to become the very first black catfish producer in the United States with half the money they get, with half the ponds they usually have. But, you know, he's running out of debt. He's running a deficit from when he starts. He starts losing land almost immediately. And the story kind of ends there because he cannot sustain this impossible, almost inhuman effort. And he really dies in foreclosure.
Mm.
Or he enters old age in foreclosure and loses most of his land.
Mm. Well, Van, hang on here for just a second, because joining us now from Clarksdale, Mississippi, is Willina Scott White. She is a farmer and a retired educator in Mississippi. We're talking about her family right now. She and her family farm roughly 1,100 acres today. And as Van's told us, that land that her family farms has been in the family since the turn of the last century. So, Willina Scott White, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
How's the farm doing today?
The farm is doing well today. We're suffering the same trials that other farmers in the area. We are trying to be sure that we maintain at a level where we are sustainable.
And but it sounds it sounds like that's not as easy as you'd like it to be.
Oh no, it's not. Because basically, when we got back into farming, the land had not been farmed for approximately 29 years, some of it. So, and we had no equipment because everything was taken at foreclosure. So we literally in 2014 had to buy all new equipment and get into farming, which is quite expensive in this century.
Uh-huh. Well, so tell us a little bit more about what Van was talking about, that how, I mean, the land has been in your family for a long time, but through a number of challenges, it was lost, but then your family got it back. I want to hear that story a little bit more from you.
Yes, my grandfather, Ed Scott Sr., started purchasing land from P.H. Brooks in 1938. And at that time, in this area of the Mississippi Delta, there were only two white farmers. And at that time, white farmers owned thousands and thousands of acres of land. I think Mr. P.H. Brooks owned something like 7,000 acres. And he and Joe Rice Dockery were the only whites who would sell land to black farmers. And so Grandpapa bought his first 100 acres, and then as he paid for his, he encouraged each of his sons to buy their own plot of land. And my dad tells the story that instead of selling him a whole plot, which would be, you know, a block of land, that he kept one corner, and that was to divide the wealth of a black person.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you owned that whole block, then it was more valuable than if somebody owned a piece of your block of land. And so by the time Grandpapa died in 1957, he had amassed with his sons about 1,000 acres of land. And so my dad had gone to the Army and come back and opted to farm with his dad as opposed to going off to school. And they pretty much were self-sufficient. We lived on our farm. We didn't go to town a whole lot. Grandpapa went to town. So even though there was overt racism in the South, we didn't experience it because they protected us from it. Like I told Vance, it was like, now that I'm grown, I realize he kind of built a utopia for us and protected us
uh-huh.
from the outside world. The 1970s, and I was still at home at that time, we had the economy, the agriculture took a downturn,
mm-hmm.
and the row crops were going out, and the local agents, county agent told the white farmers that they needed to have catfish ponds if they were going to make it the next year. Well, they would come back and tell my dad what was said at the meetings, even though he was not always welcomed, because the whites in the area where we lived had been there, and they grew up with him as a child. So they were neighbors as well as friends.
Yeah.
And we called them nighttime friends, because they would share with him at night and they would support him, but they couldn't let their white counterparts because they would be ostracized.
Oh, I see. Well, Walina Scott-White, hold on here for just a second. And Van R. Newkirk II, we just have to take a quick break. We are talking about Van's article in The Atlantic about the story of how a million black families had their farms taken away from them over a very short period of time in American history. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Van R. Newkirk II. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he's written The Atlantic's September cover story titled The Great Land Robbery, the shameful story of how 1 million black families have been ripped from their farms. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. And we're also joined by Walina Scott-White. She's with us from Clarksdale, Mississippi. She's a farmer and retired educator in Mississippi. Her family farms roughly 1,100 acres. They've owned it since the turn of the last century when her grandfather acquired it, though we've been hearing the story about how keeping that land has been oftentimes quite challenging for the Scott family. And Van and Walina, if I may, we've got a lot of callers, so I just want to bring in a couple of them to hear their stories as well. Corey is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Corey, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Okay, well, okay. My dad grew up in a little country town in Louisiana, and his granddad owned a plot of land that was 50 acres. He had 10 children, and each child, he, you know, was going to give 5 acres. Well, one night, some of the white guys in the town got him to go out for a drink. And when they got him drunk, they forcefully, by gunpoint, made him sign over his land to them. This was in the 1930s. Maybe in 1990, it was discovered that there was oil on the land. But because, you know, my family didn't have a deed.
Yeah.
They couldn't claim any of it.
So what happened, Corey?
Oh, well, nothing. We've moved from Louisiana, so, you know, kind of giving it up.
Yeah. Well, Corey, thank you for your call. Van, what do you hear in Corey's story?
Oh, well, that's I really focused on agricultural land, but actually one thing I've heard from lots of folks like Corey, especially after this piece, is the oil rights issue in Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, in that area. It's something that I believe needs to be focused on.
Well, I mean, what Corey's call makes me think of, what his family stories makes me think of, is that, you know, the era that you're focusing in your piece, you write how that oftentimes it was legal instruments that were used that ended up being the means of dispossession, right? Those loans and the fact that black farmers weren't given those loans, the federal loans, at the same rates as white farmers did. But you also talk about illegal means of coercion as well. Can you sort that out for us?
Yeah. So the way I wanted to present it was as a continuum almost. So illegal things reinforced or enforced legal methods. So obviously, if somebody sells on it, it's foreclosed on or whatever, then that's a legal thing. But there's a shadier bit there, which is if they are discriminated against by the federal government in the form of loans, that's a little bit less legal, right? That goes against the Civil Rights Act, that goes against the 14th Amendment. If they are illegally assessed a high tax assessment for their land, which happened a lot, lots of times, state tax assessors will come out and say, you owe this much, and no, they couldn't afford it, and no, it was actually way more than what the land was worth. And that's one way they got them off. That's a little bit less legal, right? And those things were kind of reinforced by the blanketly racist and illegal thing. So if you had somebody strong-arming folks off their out of their off their land, if you had a bank saying we're not going to treat with you because you're black, if you had the Klan, you know, Klan night rides happened to dispossess lots of people because not even if they weren't necessarily because of the land itself, if you kill the landowner or run them away from their property and send them up north, now you have a vacant lot that's going up for auction. So all these things are part of a continuum, and I don't know if it's necessarily useful to draw bright lines between legal and illegal, mm-hmm. because if a land goes up for sale and auction, it's bought legally, but we don't really focus on how it got to the auction.
Right. Willina, let me have you jump back in here. I mean, does all that sound familiar to the story regarding the story of your family?
It sounds very familiar because I worked directly with the attorney who was representing my dad, and we literally went page by page through his documents trying to find the evidence. And I detailed the how things turned out. And at the time when FSA was telling the insurance company they could begin foreclosure on my dad, his note was not even due. But they were at the same time saying he's not going to be able to pay it because we're not going to loan him the money. So you can, they were saying start foreclosure in January. The note was not due until April. And we documented that in the documents we found.
Wow. Well, so Willina, let me ask you, do you feel confident about your family's future and the future of the land that your family owns?
I feel very confident.
Good.
Mainly because my dad was, he was a firm believer in God. And the 29 years that he struggled trying to get his land back, the one thing he always said was God is going to prevail. He's going to bring this land back. And that's what we've done. We stand on faith. And each year when we go into it, we pray for God's blessings. And he has blessed us these years that we've been back into it because I knew nothing about the farming part of it. My son, who works with my brother, did not, but my brother knew. So they work together, and he's training him. And our goal is to train other younger, not just black, but all young people who are interested in farming and let them know that farming is not just the tractor and the disc. There are so many other areas of farming that they can go into. And just that when you have land, you always have wealth from generation to generation. We have cousins who sold their land and said they wanted to enjoy their heritage. But you can take land and borrow on it. You pay that back. You still have that land for the next generation mm-hmm. to use. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have to teach our young people. Yes, you can get the instant money, but if you borrow and you work your lifetime, which my parents lived to be 93, and they said there's no such thing as retirement. You work until you can't work anymore.
Yeah. Well, Willina Scott-White, joining us from Clarksdale, Mississippi, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
And thank you for inviting me.
Well, Van, so what Willina just said there about the intergenerational transfer of wealth that being a landowner allows, that has to be one of the lasting dark legacies of this land loss that you're talking about, right? Because there, we could quote statistic after statistic that says that the net worth, the average net worth of a black family in the United States is a minor fraction of that of a white family. Can we draw lines back to this dispossession?
Oh, yeah. Well, and I want to make one note of what Willina was talking about. She said she's confident, and I'm confident, too. I know I talked up Ed Scott Sr. and Jr. a lot, but if you've ever gotten a chance to meet Willina, she is a force of will unto her own. She is an incredible person who is going to build a museum and going to do every single thing she wants to do to preserve her family legacy. And, you know, I believe that is firmly going to be the case. As to the question of the legacy, of the ongoing economic, racial, social legacy, you don't have to go any farther than right down the road from where we reported on in those fields. People like to point out that Mississippi is always dead last in all these socioeconomic indicators and all these measures of health status, in diabetes and obesity, in inequality and poverty. I'd go and look exactly at the places where dispossession of the sort that I'm reporting on is the most intense, where Black folks have the most and lose the most. And they correlate pretty sharply, pretty strongly with the areas where all the little metrics of dysfunction keep popping up. Hmm. What's that tell you? And I'm not a data analyst or statistician or anything, but I think it's undeniable that the fact that Black folks were stripped of their land, that they were discriminated against so heavily that they were made into a permanent, not just a rental class, but a class that could not legally ever possess anything from generation to generation. What does that do to your family structure? What does it do to your ability to go seek an education? What does it do to your ability to think about the future? I think it's clear that the dispossession of the sort that we're talking about, that the inability of Black folks to become landowners, to have a collect, to have neighborhoods that belong to them, those are things that played heavily in the current state of Black America and the creation of the racial wealth gap is what people focus on now, and in all of these health disparities too.
Who owns the land now?
Right now, a good portion of the land in the Mississippi Delta and also just across lots of swaths of American farmland, especially where African Americans live, it's owned by investors, by Wall Street, by big pension funds. Actually, pension funds alone own more land in the Mississippi Delta than do Black folks. And there's only like 9 pension funds that are investing significantly there.
Hmm. But that isn't unique to the land lost by Black farmers, though. I mean, as you were saying earlier, small farmers of all backgrounds have had a really hard time, and that land has been transferred to Wall Street.
Right. So the National Family Farm Coalition decried an institutional investment, Wall Street investment in farmland across all races and across not just the Mississippi Delta, but Kansas, the Midwest. Lots of places are facing this same challenge. And it's one that mirrors what's happening in real estate across the country. Right. After the Great Recession, we saw Wall Street step in a major way and buy up lots of land that used to be owned by families. But what I will say is that in places where the loss was the sharpest, was the heaviest, and has been the most extreme, and where, frankly, there is the most land to buy, those areas have been the places where this dispossession, this racial dispossession against Black folks happened. It just stands to reason that in a place, if you want to invest in land, you have to go to a place where land is available.
Mm-hmm.
And the places where land is most available is going to be where you have the most vulnerable people. They happen to be African-American. They happen to be Latino. And that is what the state of the affairs is right now.
Well, let's go to Courtney, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Courtney, you're on the air.
Wow. This is an amazing conversation. Thank you guys for having it. I just wanted to point out a couple of issues, you know. I'm here and I'm a Navy veteran. I'm having difficulty getting housing. But when I listen to the conversation, I don't hear anybody really talking about reparations, locations of this land, or what Black people own just being Black people and what we've done to get this land. And I'm hearing the farm owners talk about the land, and they're not really talking about the food that they're producing on the land, because a lot of the land that exists for white owners, they producing food, but who are they producing the food for? And I've never heard not one of you guys talk about maybe how African Americans could possibly own their own state. Who are African Americans? What do we own? And what do we have? What do we eat? These are all important questions. In regards to ownership of the land.
Yeah, Courtney, we've just got 3 minutes left here, so I want to give Van some time to dig into to what you said. Let's just focus, Van, on the reparations part of Courtney's comments there. This is obviously a big question.
Well, I'd say I do mention this pretty extensively in the piece itself. So this is my time to plug The Atlantic. I would go out and get a copy of The Atlantic magazine and check it out. And also talk about the reparation should be couched. The conversation around reparation should be couched in the fact that what African Americans lost was not just land. It was a chance to have a state like Mississippi, which was majority black. They did lose political strength in that way. So that's a big part of this conversation that I don't believe has entered necessarily into even the reparations debate. I would also check out work from Leah Penniman, who's the director of Soulfire Farm. She talks a lot about this too, about the food justice aspect of land loss and what it means to control the production of food.
So, I do want to circle back on this reparations question to something you said at near the beginning of our conversation, because the earliest owners of the land were the Choctaw, as you said.
Yeah.
So how does that figure into this? If we're going to talk about have an honest conversation about reparations, how does that figure into this?
Well, this is one thing that I wish that I'd done a little bit more work on in the piece. Obviously, I have editors and I can't write as long as I always want to write. But we have to begin this conversation with the acknowledgement and with a serious policy discussion on what it means that the land was originally stolen, not just stolen. It was violently wrested from the indigenous Americans who lived there in the first place. And we have to begin the conversation with some recognition of indigenous sovereignty, of the fact that those folks lived there, and of the fact that they were moved off the land, that they were killed for it because it was valuable. And how do we have a conversation around reparations that takes that into account? Now, I'm not the guy who is putting all these conversations on reparations together. I don't have exactly all the answers, but I don't believe we can have a full, honest and balanced conversation about those things without talking about the indigenous folks and what's been done to them when we talk about land. Because, yeah, the story of land and Native Americans in this country is one that is, you know, even deeper and more tragic than what we're talking about in this story.
Well, Van R. Newkirk II, he is a staff writer at The Atlantic magazine, and he's author of September's cover story. It's called The Great Land Robbery, the shameful story of how 1 million black families have been ripped from their farms. Van, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, we have a link to Van's article at onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poley, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from David Marino and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.